morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 10th of September. It's all things political for this hour, which you always hear on Mondays at 9. We hope in a moment to connect with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. She has an interesting piece out today on the bump that the Democrats seem to have received as a result of their convention. The president leads Republican challenger Mitt Romney by 5 percentage points in the Gallup poll and 4 points in the Reuters, Ipsos, and Rasmussen polls that reflected a swing of 4 to 7 points from their standing before the Democratic convention opened on Tuesday, and the approval rating went up as well for the president. However, it is possible, she writes, that the disappointing jobs report released on Friday could dampen movement toward Obama. We'll be talking about those numbers, about the quality of both of the conventions, why the president's approval numbers seem to have gone up as a result of the convention last week. And she will join us, we hope, in just a few moments. A little bit later, we will look at those job numbers. They showed that only 96,000 jobs were gained last month. Were there any parts of the economy that were blooming? And how can new jobs be created? We'll have as our guest a contributing writer for Bloomberg Business Week. So that's coming up the second half hour of the show. As always, you are welcome to join this conversation. Let me give you our phone number, and it is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave those messages on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We like to hear from you. So that's the deal for the first hour of the program. We're still trying to connect with Susan. So in the meantime, we may just take your phone calls. Why do you think the president's numbers went up as a result of the Democratic convention? Do you imagine they'll go down again when the next poll is taken, which probably will be today? There are always polls as a result of the disappointing jobs numbers last Friday. So here is our phone number. We'll count on you until we can reach Susan. 800-486-8655 is our number. Lines are open for you to be our guest at the moment, at least, for all things political. Just a reminder, too, on September 26th, we're starting a book club. We haven't done this for years and years and years. And on September 26th, we talk about the first selection in our Back to School book club. It's going to be a conversation of Common Sense by Thomas Paine, 10 o'clock on September 26th. It's not a long but a very, very important little book or essay on what it means to be an American, really. And that will be on September 26th. We hope you'll join our conversation. All right, we'll hope to connect with Susan Page here momentarily. In the meantime, let's just open up our lines for all things political. What did you think of both conventions? We haven't had a chance to talk to each other since the president spoke at the convention on Thursday night of last week. You may want to give your reaction to that speech, but mostly the polls showing that the president got a bit of a bounce, maybe 5 points. Mitt Romney got a little bounce, not as substantial, from the Republican convention. What did you make of the meat, the essence of both of those conventions? Let's start with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Pretty well, thank you. What I wanted to talk about was covered both in an older book, but also in yesterday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, both in the front page and local sections. The older book is Profit Without Honor, White Collar Crime and the Looting of America. And in the book, Ralph Nader made a very good statement many years ago. He said that pollution equals postponed violence. And in yesterday's Milwaukee Journal, there were two articles. One was toxic chemicals left in a building. And that was a story about a problem of pollution in Slinger, which has yet to be addressed and is potentially very threatening to the health of the people there. And then also on the front page, there was an article that said coal ash puts ferries' future in rough waters. And there's been a ferry that has been dumping coal ash into the waters of Lake Michigan, which constitute the drinking water for 10 million people. And with the help of Congressman Petrie, they've been trying to forestall dealing with that problem, which could be put as potentially a threat. So again, if people are really interested in protection of life, one of the ways to do it is through strong regulation of the environment, and that's a clear-cut contrast between the Republicans and the Democrats. And people ought to think about that when they vote, because if you don't have your health, you don't have anything.
So you were pleased then that the president brought up global warming in his address.
Yes, that was good, and I'd like to hear more from the administration as they go along, though, on the need to protect the environment, because, cancer-causing chemicals are a postponed threat for us in many, many different ways.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. Our phone number, and we're counting on you to be our All Things Political analyst, Susan Page, we hope to reach, but we can't at this moment. We're talking about the conventions, particularly about the boost that the president seems to have received as a result of his convention, although the jobs numbers on Friday were disappointing, and we'll see if future polls reflect a disappointment in this administration. What did you think of what you saw? What did you think of the president's address on Thursday? We haven't had a chance to talk since then. Do you think these numbers will hold or not? What states are you looking at as crucial states in this election? And what about those debates? Those are coming up really soon. October 3rd is the first. It'll be here before you know it. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and lines are open for you right now. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello. I think that people have it wrong when they're thinking about job creation. Republicans have a right when they say that the government's limited in terms of its power to create jobs. On the other hand, they have it wrong when they try to deregulate business, because business's job is not to create jobs. Their job is to eliminate jobs. They want to create their products and services using as little labor as possible. In fact, if they could reinstitute slavery, that would be the best thing. I mean, for example, Ron Johnson. He uses in his plastics factory, Senator Ron Johnson, he has a deal with the Department of Corrections to use the prison labor to do a lot of the work. And that's great for him because he pays them extremely little, and he doesn't have to worry about housing, clothing, feeding, keeping them healthy. And so, the private sector wants to eliminate jobs. They'd like to do their products and services without any. And if they can't get it cheaply here, at least if they have to hire labor, they'd rather do it elsewhere because it's cheaper.
All right. Thank you, Bill, very much for your call. Let's go to Tom next in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. How are you, Kathleen?
All right, Tom. How are you?
Real well. I'd like to point out or talk about the president and the numbers. I think the debates he's going to actually show. And he will, I should say, he's actually show up, Romney, because Romney is too much flip-flops and everything, and I think Barack will stay on point, I hope. Another thing that your previous caller was talking about, the coal ash being dumped in the lake, and while I agree that it is a serious issue, you can also look, though, back in history when the Great Lakes were full of steam engines and they were all dumping coal ash in the lake. I would like to see that stop, but you know, again, I can see, you know, the quandary there. And in that article, it also pointed out about, one paragraph it talked about the coal ash, and in the next paragraph it talked about that this would kill jobs. And the environmentalists and the Republicans go back and forth, but to me, is it more important to gain jobs or is it more important to save the environment? And I kind of like to side on the environment in this case, or many cases.
All right. Thanks, Tom, very much for the call. You are becoming our All Things Political guests this hour. And it's fine. We can take a lot of phone calls here. I'd like for, if you could, please, to center on why you think the president's poll numbers are, so we're all on the same page here, why the president's poll numbers are up today. Do you think that they will go down as a result of the jobs report and jobs being all important, who do you think could handle this best? What did you think of the quality of both conventions? Was it a result of the convention that the president's numbers are up? 800-486-8655 is our number, and we go to Art in Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi. Well, in terms of the conventions, I think it's pretty clear the Democrats ran a very smooth one other than the platform ridiculous vote. The Republicans, you know, Carville was on, and James Carville and was asked about Romney's for a big bump and that they projected a big bump. And he said, well, those are the people that put on Clint Eastwood, so you know, you can judge from there. So they just didn't pull off a very good convention. But I'd like to talk about substance just a bit more. If you look at the talk shows this weekend, Sunday morning on Meet the Press, Romney was really pushing how we have to increase money in the military budget even more than the Pentagon wants. Ryan on Face the Nation was challenged for being inconsistent on that. And the prevailing wisdom is for states like Wisconsin, more military spending is not very good, but some other states it's maybe better. But if jobs is the issue, the fact is that military spending is a job destroyer compared to spending $1 billion on education. Creates about 26,000 jobs, 11,000 jobs only if it's on military spending. So it destroys 15,000 jobs. And the whole push of them, because they can't get Obama on being weak on military actions because of, you know, the assassination of Osama and all that sort of stuff. So now they're just pushing, pump more money, take it away from domestic needs and put it into military spending. And that's why you could say they are budget hawks, only in the sense that they want to change the budget into more and more military, which is very bad for jobs and very bad for Wisconsin.
All right. Thanks, Art, very much for the call. We're going to continue all things political. Robin Farzad will be joining us, contributing writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. The jobs numbers came out last week, and we're starting this part of the conversation a little bit early, although I'm sure that Robin can comment on the uptick in the numbers for President Obama that we're seeing yesterday. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robin Farzad, contributing writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, is joining us now for all things political. Robin, thank you so much for being with us. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for being with us. We were talking a little bit about the numbers that showed that the president received a little bit more than a small bump as a result of the convention. The numbers for the jobs that were released on Friday that were fairly disappointing, these poll numbers don't reflect the jobs numbers, do they?
No, they don't, but really the song has remained the same on the jobs front, just woefully inadequate creation of new jobs, not just to dig us out of the millions of jobs that we've lost since the onset of the Great Recession, but we've since grown population of people who want to be gainfully employed. And just to give you an idea, something like 96,000 private jobs created is nowhere near the something on the order of 330,000 jobs a month that we'd need sustainably over several years to get us back to the pre-recession unemployment rate.
And there's one more report that comes out before the election, or are there two?
I think there are two, mm-hmm. If I'm not correct. Maybe one just for October, sorry.
Were there any good news stories from this jobs number? Were there any segments of the economy that were performing well?
Well, I mean, extremely difficult to find silver linings in that. I mean, the actual rate fell because more people are dropping out. It seems like this is an economy of learned helplessness after such a prolonged period of the unemployment rate being above 8%. I think it's the longest stretch of above 8% unemployment since maybe World War II or that post-World War II period. People are just saying, you know what, I'm pushing on a string at this point. I'm hitting my head against the wall. And so it fell because you effectively have a smaller denominator if you're trying to calculate the percentage. Having said that, if you put the unemployment rate aside, it's like there's a bifurcated economy going on right now because corporate profits are at an all-time high and the stock market is at a near five-year high. And so there are people out there who are feeling their oats if it's not on the jobs front.
Mm-hmm. Former President Clinton, in an article in The New Yorker this week, was quoted as telling donors, it takes 10 years to recover from a financial crisis rooted in a housing collapse. And by that historical standard, Obama was beating the clock, not behind it. How do you respond to that?
It's a very hard sell to make because I think generationally no one has experienced a housing crisis or a systemic collapse, anything on the order of what we just saw in 2008 and 2009. I mean, some people remember the crash of 87. A handful of people might remember the savings and loan crisis or the dreariness of the 1970s, but there was no big kind of, you know, asteroid crashing into the earth event the way we saw 4 years ago when Lehman Brothers failed and AIG was bailed out. So asking for forbearance, asking for continued patience is a very difficult thing to do when, you know, generationally you don't have that many people out there who remember the Great Depression very well or who were of working age during the Great Depression and
yes,
maybe lost money in the crash of 29. There are a handful out there, but increasingly they're passing away.
Do you, Robin, see the two parties as giving us entirely different philosophies as to how to get jobs back in this country?
There is a difference there. With the Obama administration, you remember in the first 100 days, there was all this talk of shovel ready and let's get money out the door. And there was this Keynesian element of kind of priming the pump the government has to spend to get us out. You do see Romney and Ryan espouse much more of a get corporate tax rates down. Let's promise that capital gains and dividend rates will be kept down so that the top 1 or 5 or 10%, as it were, can sprinkle more money down into the economy. Whether you call that trickle down or whatever else you want to call it, you know, rose by any other name. It's really debating the size of government at this point. You have many left-leaning economists out there who are saying that we haven't spent enough, even with the Federal
right.
Reserve at record monetary stimulative bias. They're saying that you need much more fiscal stimulus, and obviously the impasse in D.C. is not allowing any side to really say, yeah, let's give the other side a chance.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that this election, no matter who wins, will force that both sides are going to have to say we have to give the other side a chance here and help fashion policy?
Well, one thing that'll force in the meantime is the fiscal cliff. And you see that kind of brinksmanship, that kind of 11-hour dealing that we saw even before last year's debt downgrade, where you kind of come to some sort of stopgap measure where you can kick this down the road for another 6 to 12 months. But there's no indication here that the Democrats, if Mr. Obama is reelected, that the Democrats can take back the House, that if anything, the Republicans are looking to gain more seats in the House, and they have a shot at taking back the Senate. The divided government is the order of the day. And unfortunately, things would have to get markedly worse, and we'd have to take another leg down for there to be enough fury from the electorate that both sides would be forced to lock themselves up in a room and come out with some sort of agreement.
What do you mean by getting worse? What are you talking about?
Another step down. Right now what we're feeling is kind of chronic. It's ongoing. You just get used to this new normal, this chronically high unemployment, chronically poor job creation, people just feeling that this has gone on forever. If you have anything that approximates what we saw in terms of Wall Street's meltdown or something systemic happen with Europe and institutional bank failures, you could see hands forced. If for nothing else, for photo op diplomacy for the leaders of Congress and for the White House to step forward and say we have the situation cordoned off. But I see that if you continuously see a more of a kind of a slow burn situation where what you see is what you get, and the economy is not breaking out of its rut. Is there enough of a spark of indignation to force these guys to get together in a matter of 48 hours and propose something? I think that really remains an open question.
Let's take a couple phone calls for you. Elaine in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Excuse me. Pretty good. I just want to make three quick points. one, another thing that distinguishes the Democrats' approach to job development from the Republicans is that they believe in government-sponsored research creating commercial applications that in turn create companies and jobs. Two, Clinton did a really good job in his speech inoculating the Democrats against disappointment in the 96,000 private sector job creation figures that just came out by making the contrast to the 750 jobs a month that were being lost under Bush. And that was especially effective since the Republicans didn't even want to bring out their former president to talk. And then last, I think the best evidence to your earlier questions about whether the bounce would last, I think the best evidence that the bounce is going to last has to probably come from the Republicans' recent panic, because over the weekend you saw Romney suddenly saying, well, you know, there were some pretty good things about Obama's foreign policy, and yes, we're safer. He qualified that by saying just a little bit safer. And, of course, also him saying that there were aspects of the Obamacare legislation that he planned to keep, even though his staff then later had him back off. He went on a long tangent at one of his appearances about how he'd like to keep various aspects of it and how he was, in fact, in favor of various aspects of it. So I think that's a sign of panic and waffling, that where he's desperately running towards the middle because he's seen that people respond well to those aspects of Obama's policy and governance. So thanks.
Thanks, Elaine, for the call. Robin.
Yes, you're going to see a creep back to the center as the election approaches. I mean, you have to throw red meat out to the base. This is nothing new for you or your listeners. I mean, approaching convention season to secure the nomination, but over the next 30, 60 days or so, it's going to be about, I think, selective prevarication and saying that I can, in fact, work with the other side. And if you judge Romney on what he's done, not just on what he's been saying for the past year and a half, he has been able to strike deals with Democrats when he was last holding office as governor of Massachusetts. He has been amenable to New England Republican centrist economic sensibilities, which clearly a lot of the remaining members of that mini caucus, if you will, are still amenable to working with President Obama. So I think that nothing is out of the question at this point. It's just a matter of who wins. And indeed, if you see Mitt Romney win and he has the Republican House behind him and you have a weakened Democratic Senate, that a lot more is possible the other way around.
Put on your political hat for a moment. When Romney on Meet the Press was talking about health care reform and saying that he liked the pre-existing conditions, part of the care program that he liked, that families could get their children covered up to whatever age they may like, it's not really the platform or the consensus of a lot of people in the Republican Party that those parts are okay and the others are not good. They're calling for a repeal of Obamacare completely. Why did he do that? Who is he stepping out to try and get into his camp?
Because the obverse of that is very hard to defend. I mean, if you had one of the Tea Party guys up there on Meet the Press and you said, would you deprive children of emergency health care, would you deprive the neediest in our culture, I think that they would selectively dance around that subject instead of saying, no, we're taking the whole thing down, the whole thing is wretched. And that's consistent with what you are increasingly going to see out of Mitt Romney as he looks to secure the elusive, the undecided, the self-declared centrists and independents over the next 30 days.
Ryan in Waterloo, Iowa. Hi.
Hello, Robert.
How are you?
Hello?
Yeah, you're with us. Go ahead, Ryan.
Okay. There's a couple points I want to make. For the jobs, there's jobs out there here in Waterloo, Iowa. There's jobs out there, but they're on the outskirts. And what I focus on is like a minority. I'm African American, the minority aspect. Here in Iowa, minorities make up 11% of the unemployed. In the nation, it makes up 14%. If we can get those jobs back into those type of communities that people that need them, we'll get the unemployment rate down and we'll start creating new jobs. Because there's a desire for in those inner cities for people to work, but it's not feasible for them to travel across time 20 to 30 minutes away to work. It's not financially feasible. On the second aspect, what makes President Obama popular compared to Romney is when President Obama ran the first time, he brought out a blueprint for change. He has not strayed away from that change, that blueprint. It's in writing. He sticks to it. He has been on point every time when it comes to his his document that he created, saying this is what I plan to do and this is what I want to do on Romney's behalf, is unknowing. We don't know. There's nothing in writing. It changes every day on what he's going to do and how his policies are going to affect America. So that's what I feel. That's why President Obama is up on numbers, and that's why he's more popular than Romney right now.
Thank you, Ryan, for the call. Robin?
Well, the thing about an economic calamity of the kind we've seen in the past four and a half years is that you go back to the Depression, and there was this term, if you remember from your high school history, they call it leveling tendencies. That the one, I guess, cold comfort that you could take away from something like this is that it brings all manner of social economic strata down. I mean, with the exception of the very top and people who are disproportionately invested in the stock market and linked to corporate profits, which I've said before have done very well. Really, the majority of this country right now is in the same boat and realizes that that gainful employment is not something that you can take for granted. So whether you're in the inner cities, whether you're in the exurbs and the suburbs that experienced such a boom in the middle part of the decade, you're really on the same page. You realize that there's a paucity of enough good quality jobs with living wages and benefits, and you would be behind anyone who kind of has the silver bullet that could solve this. On the part on Romney not having a plan, actually, he has been, forced over the past 5 or 6 months to step forward with a pretty detailed regimen in the way of what he would do in terms of immediate tax stimulus and cutting taxes across the board, whether you're talking about the marginal income tax rates or capital gains or preservation of low dividend taxation. So I think both of them do have things on paper and. On platitude at the same time.
Let's go to Bruce in Toma. Hi, Bruce.
Yes. I always wonder why it's got to be either or, Democrats or Republicans, and they both can't be right, and that it could be possible that they're both wrong. And I kind of think that one of the stimulus ideas that I've thought of is to – are you still there?
Yes, we're here.
Okay. That I've thought of, and that is to stimulate the economy, is to increase the personal exemption rate when people file their taxes. And like a personal exemption rate now is $3,750. If that could be increased to, say, $7,500, that would have people out there spending money, saving money, or investing money one way or the other, and be able to afford and bring back their own housing and buy products and such as refrigerators or cars or whatever, because I amount to about another $300 a month.
All right, Robin?
If you think about all the fiscal and monetary reactions to this economic downturn, there's been no shortage of creativity. You look at the Federal Reserve, and in addition to the traditional instrument of lowering short-term interest rates, it's had to conjure up money out of thin air, $2.5 trillion of monetary easing. And if you look at reactions from both the White House and Capitol Hill, you've had things as creative as cash for clunkers. Remember that? There was effectively cash for mortgages when you had the forgiveness of, I don't remember, was it an $8,000 or $9,000 cash credit for first-time new home buyers? I mean, who knows if you could have cash for jobs at a certain point. I mean, nothing, the longer this goes on, the more pressure there is going to be for policymakers to reach for non-traditional tools or weapons to kind of combat the chronically high joblessness that we have. And then, again, the longer that this goes on, the more both sides, I think both the Democrats and the Republicans, take the hit. Let's not forget that the financial crisis, the explosion happened under George W. Bush's watch. There was a honeymoon period where Obama had the chance to come out with shock and awe and have his fiscal stimulus ready. And the longer this has happened, the more that kind of the situation has transmogrified into the crisis in Europe, the more it's been put on President Obama's plate. But it doesn't help, I think, any party. It doesn't help the Hill. Doesn't help the White House for this to keep going on for several more years.
Mm-hmm. Sure doesn't help people who are looking for jobs, does it? You mentioned the Fed and monetary policy. Let's spend a few moments talking about what to me is a fairly complicated issue, so make it so I can understand it. Here's Governor Romney again on Meet the Press yesterday responding to the jobs numbers that we've been talking about and talking about the Fed and monetary policy.
Very, very troubling. And, of course, the stock market does well, in part because the indication by the Fed that they're going to print more money, pour more money into the system, says we're likely to have down the road high inflation, and where else are you going to go? If interest rates are going to be near zero, investors have to go somewhere to protect against inflation, and the stock market's the only place to go.
You don't think the Fed ought to be any more involved at this point?
Well, I don't think that easing monetary policy is going to make a significant difference in the job market right now. I think what the nation needs is a change in fiscal policy.
There are reports that the Fed will be more involved in fiscal policy. Can you explain if that is likely to happen and what exactly that means in making the economy better, or you may think it would make it worse? I don't know.
Well, the Fed does control monetary policy, and Mr. Rahmi has a point. You know, have you ever had a period of almost 4 years of zero interest rate policy where effectively that kind of money is free? You know what you're getting on a savings account right now. It's zilch. You know that the short-term treasuries are offering essentially nothing. Other economies have seen negative interest rates. And if that hasn't stimulated anything, as I said, Mr. Bernanke reached for non-traditional tools in creating money to buy trillions of dollars of bonds in order to keep longer rates down. So what does he have left in his arsenal? I saw today a headline that the market is looking for a third round of that kind of conjuring of money to buy up bond assets. But Romney is spot on. This hasn't done much for the job market. It's not as if, you know, we haven't seen a spillover, for example, in the stock market being at a near four and a half, five-year high, and then companies feeling emboldened enough to go out and hire hundreds of thousands of people a month in order to put a true dent in the unemployment rate. What Bernanke can do is exercise more moral suasion when he testifies before the Senate or when he meets with Mr. Obama and says, hey, guys, you need to get your act together. Unfortunately, he doesn't have the same clout that, say, Alan Greenspan had at the outset of the Clinton presidency to lean on Bill Clinton and say, for example, that balancing the budget should be your chief priority. You can give, you know, when the Federal Reserve chairman was much more of an exalted figure, it could give Capitol Hill, the White House, regardless of party, any sort of cover to do something because it looked like you knew what you were doing. But 4 years into Bernanke kind of pushing on a string and really kind of racking his brain to figure out monetary responses, he just doesn't have the same currency that an Alan Greenspan or even a Paul Volcker 30 years ago had.
Carla in La Crosse. Hi. Are you there, Carla? Not there. Let's go next to Deb in Plymouth. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I was struck by the different tones of the conventions. I finally had to turn off the Republican convention because of the negativity. I was in Charlotte last week, not as a delegate, but I had a ticket to get in the Thursday, and actually did get in to see Bill Clinton, which was great. And the excitement down there was fabulous. But I heard a statistic yesterday that bothered me. I heard that the wealth of the bottom 40% of Americans is equal to the Walton family right now. You know, businesses need to get customers, and that's what's going to help the economy. Are there any specifics on how many good-paying jobs the Walton family has created, since they seem to have a monopoly on the wealth in America right now?
Well, I have seen a couple of data points, and I hope that they're germane to your question. I have seen that Walmart stock recently hit an all-time high. So is that necessarily a good thing? Well, people are buying more, but Walmart also has a literally desperate audience. I did a piece on if you go to Walmart's on the last day of every month, just before midnight, there are lines at the cash registers for people waiting for their food stamp cards to recharge. So hand-to-mouth are they, literally. And so it's kind of a mixed blessing when you see a company like Walmart thrive. But no, I mean, Walmart does not create quality jobs per se. You know, if you're a greeter or a customer service associate in a store, but any job, I think, at this point. So many people are settling. So many people are underemployed, and you see them taking jobs that they never imagined they would take. Any of these jobs would be welcome. I mean, you look at Amazon.com, a growing company, when it builds these fulfillment centers across the country, these warehouses, you invariably see long lines around the block for all walks of life of people who are signing up to take warehouse jobs. I mean, this has been the great humbling, if not just the great recession.
Here's an email from John. there are jobs or there is the potential for jobs, but the workforce isn't trained or educated for the level of expertise needed. South Asian countries are teaching computer programming to first graders.
There's a good point there. If you look at, for example, how South Korean children are prepared for school, the level of math, the level of sciences that they're taught, and the time spent in school and the tutoring that their parents dish out for, I mean, it outclasses what we do. And you've seen a payoff for a country like South Korea, some of these countries in Asia that have that many of the technological manufacturing jobs have moved to. But, you know, with a big proviso, big caution is that if you look at Apple's manufacturing in China, the hundreds of thousands of employees that Foxconn, its contract manufacturer, brings in to kind of churn out iPads and iPods, it's not exactly a job that Americans want, kind of an assembly line sweatshop type job that we may have been par for the course in 1905 America. It's very much natural for the economy to shed old jobs, old types of jobs that people in the United States really would not desire, but you have to have something else pop up in their stead. You have to, when so many jobs were lost in Detroit, for example, 20 years ago, you had a booming biotechnology sector appear in the corridors of Minnesota, and certain people were able to retrain and parlay in existence as an auto assembly line worker, an electronics person, or electrical engineer into a biotech engineer. That's the kind of retooling and retraining that this economy has called for, and you're seeing those in the numbers of people who are enrolling in adult education and community college. The numbers have just surged over the past 4 years.
And Robin, whatever happened to all the jobs that were to be created in the green energy field?
That is a huge, we call it the Great Green Dream.
It's a dream.
Well, it made so much sense. You think about the summer of 2008 when oil, the price of crude oil, peaked above $140 a barrel, which very well could have pushed the economy into recession, could have been a major factor. There was this goal out there, Wall Street was pitching it too, that, look, the alternative energy space right now could be such a double blessing, both in the creation of quality jobs and weaning the country from its dependence on oil. And you saw firms like Solyndra pop up. You saw an enormous bubble in investing in biofuels and nanotech technologies that can be used in the clean energy space. I profiled a waste-to-energy company that General Motors was backing in Illinois. And the recession promptly saw oil prices collapse from, I think, $140 to below $40. And then all these companies could not stand on their own 2 feet. And the Solyndra controversy really blew back on the White House. It showed that when you pick a national champion or when you have industrial policy, it's generally not as good and as cold-eyed as venture capitalists coming in and on their own volition investing in these companies. It's an extremely tricky thing because you see it work in some countries like Israel. You see it work to a certain extent in more centrally planned economies in Europe, but it has not caught on in the United States. Having said that, you should, if you go back and look at the Clinton presidency in the first 100 days when the meetings were first held in the White House and people were pondering the enormous, then it looked like an enormous recession that we were coming off of, not one person in the room, not any of his economic advisors mentioned the Internet. And that turned out to be the biggest economic trend of the rest of the decade, and that is something that just came out of left field. So, similarly, if innovation continues, the economy is bound to be sparked by something on that order.
We continue our conversation and take more phone calls. Our guest this part of the show on All Things Political is Robin Farzad, contributing writer at Bloomberg Business Week. Our phone number is 800-486-8655 because of the work that he does and the jobs report that came out on Friday and the fact that creating jobs in the economy will remain the central issue of this campaign. That's what we're focusing on All Things Political. 800-486-8655, the number. And you can also send us an email, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our show, a recent piece in the Atlantic Fear of a Black President. The author will join us. He writes that in order to achieve full integration, blacks must be twice as good, but half as black. That's our two. Carla in La Crosse, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment and then ask the guest something. It's the Republicans have coined the term job creators, and it seems as though they have portrayed themselves as demigods, that they are the ones that are going to create jobs. And it seems like they're reconfiguring the jobs economy to make it so that people are grateful to have any kind of job, regardless of the wages or the amount of hours they get or any benefits. That's my comment. And then I also wanted to ask the guest, you mentioned earlier in the show that the corporations are making all-time high profits and the stock market is high, yet there are many people unemployed. Can you explain how we got there and what are the implications for that to our democracy? Thank
you. Let's take that latter question. When you have this kind of explosion, you know, to use the metaphor, crash at the intersections of Main Street and Wall Street, I know it's a tortured metaphor, but it really happened in a way that it never happened before. You had Wall Street firms cut off, credit cut off within a matter of weeks. All sorts of people who had depended on housing wealth, entire swaths of the economy taken out. You had Detroit collapse. You had people, husband, cash. There were literally fund managers out there who were telling their wives to take tens of thousands of dollars out of bank accounts and stick it under the mattress.
Oh, so my.
It's a panic period that we haven't seen maybe since the panic of 1907. So when that happens and credit is cut off, companies start to have this existential contemplation in their heads. What I was doing for the past 5 years, was that all fluff? Was that imagined? Was I basing it on a prosperity, my hiring demand projections that just didn't exist? And so while that was happening, they laid off first and asked questions later. And you very quickly saw the economy lose 8 million jobs. It's very rare for that to happen in such a compressed period. Now, the rebound from that, even though the economy maybe it hit bottom at some point in 2009, you have not seen companies emboldened in a way to go out and say, to hire an extra worker, I need to get a return on investment on that worker. Otherwise, I'm going to squeeze as much as I can out of every other employee that I have who should be lucky to have a job here. So that calculation and that stasis has been going on now for the better part of 3 years. And unless there is a spark out there, unless you as an employer say that I am missing out unless I bring on new payroll, you're largely going to see the economy stuck around this unemployment rate, especially as the past 3 and 4 years have created millions of new workers in terms of natural growth of the labor force. So we don't just need to go back to the number we were at, let's say at that point in mid-2007. We need to exceed it to get back to a quote-unquote natural unemployment rate.
At a real basic level, how important is it who we elect to the presidency to right the course of the economy? Is it something that's in his or her control, or is it in the control at this point of people on Wall Street or somebody else, other countries in the world? How important is that one person?
It's certainly important because you get to some degree carte blanche in terms of fiscal policy in the honeymoon period in your first 100 days, especially if you have at least one of the houses of Capitol Hill in your own party. But let's not forget, so much of this is baked into the vagaries of the economic cycle. You have historians who say that poor George Bush Sr. got short shrifted because the economy was just on the brink of recovering as he lost that election to Bill Clinton. So, of course, Bill Clinton gets all that credit going into 93 and 94 when maybe, just maybe, the cycle itself just bottomed out. The economic cycle is one of when you get enough people who are out of work, you get a downward pressure on wages and prices, that sows the seeds of its own demise. What is so different this time is that it's been going on for so long and there hasn't been enough of an attraction for corporations and for employers or for prospective purchasers to go out in mass and say buy, 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 whether it's a house, it's an employee, it's a lawnmower. There is so much skepticism and so much shell shock in the wake of what happened in 2008.
Let's go to Kyle in Madison. Hi, Kyle.
Kyle, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go right ahead, please.
Basically, my question and my comment is that this is a wives' tale that Americans or Wisconsinites don't want those iPhone assembling type of jobs. Well, geez, go ask those people in Janesville if they want to assemble car alternators and starters or put windshields in Priuses or whatever the cars they made in Janesville were. They're assembling. It doesn't matter whether you're assembling a phone or an automobile. People in Wisconsin, in any other state in the country, except the exception of maybe like California, where you have an educated population that comes from other states, so you can't compare that state. But they want any job you give them. They don't care if it's making iPhones or not. It's the corporations don't want to say, I make iPhones. They want to say, I have a biotech firm. You cannot force the entire population of your country into high-tech jobs. There is other places for them, and a great way to do it is to stop giving tax cuts to corporations to take those jobs to other countries.
Robin.
Well, it reminds me of an interesting story. The late Steve Jobs, the founder and CEO of Apple, very exalted as the innovator of the iPhone and the iPad. And Apple is a company that right now is at an all-time high. It's the largest market valuation of any company in history. It's really hitting its stride. It's going to launch the iPhone 5 tomorrow. I mean, everything is going right for this company, and it compels Obama, when he invited Steve Jobs and a handful of other Silicon Valley greats to the White House for dinner, he said, why can't the iPhone be built in the United States? What's keeping us from doing it? And Jobs says it was impossible because the level of sophistication that has been invested in the supply chain in China, if you look at the manufacturer of these phones, Foxconn, which has hundreds of thousands of poorly paid but very eager workers who are there on assembly lines, who take very short breaks, who are very eager to put together these pieces with extremely repetitive and rote movements. The logistical challenges that just go into putting a facility like that together, something that I read that all the hogs that have to be butchered to put a cafeteria of that size in order, the dormitories that they have to put up, these are things that Rust Belt America has long ago since ceded. And China, for 30 years, has been investing in becoming the electronics manufacturing epicenter of the world. This was something that was very much industrial policy for the Chinese government going back into the 1970s, where it wasn't in the United States. So to retool, to be nimble, to be relevant, and to offer the wages, frankly, I don't believe that that's something that the United States can do at this point. You'd really have to reinvent the wheel in a business that needs you to be kind of ready yesterday.
Thanks.
You see how quickly these iPhones come out.
Thanks, Kyle. Bud, probably our last caller in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Bud.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you very much for the program. Hey, I'm going to touch very quickly because you've already tangentially touched what I was going to talk about. I'd like your speaker and guest to talk about fair trade as opposed to free trade, and secondarily, how the impact of subsidies, for example, like oil subsidies, impact that. Apple, and as a comment, Apple is not exactly your poster boy for nice employers, because they have to put up nets around their buildings to keep their employees from committing suicide. So if fair trade is really what this is all about, and that will spur the economy, that's what will build jobs, not monetary policy, not tax policy.
Thanks, Bud. Thanks for the call. Robin.
It's been a very valid criticism since Bill Clinton inked NAFTA going back into the early to mid-90s. But that's something that largely multiple administrations have kind of said, you know what, I'm keeping my hands off of it. Fair trade is a nice thing to have. It's a nice slogan that you can see at a Starbucks, but it's not something that a global economy, a globalized economy that's kind of ruthless, that's red in tooth and claw, can in the short term agree to espouse. Because if you have regulations here that say that we have to have these kinds of conditions and these kinds of specifications and these kinds of environmental standards, and the wage that must pass through to the employee must reach this standard of living, companies are so mercenary that they're just going to take their manufacturing abroad, where there are no questions asked in China. There are few questions asked in parts of South Asia that are taking up the slack from China. So it is a cruel, cruel world, sad to say.
Finally, give me just a 10-second or so response. While we were talking about liberal economist Paul Krugman in a recent column said, for all the pain America has suffered on his watch, Obama can fairly claim to have helped the country through a very bad patch from which it is starting to emerge. Would you agree?
Yes. I mean, the economy has bottomed. We're not in recession, theoretically, anymore, but this does not feel like a recovery. And at a certain point, you have to ask yourself, the president can't take out a checkbook and hire people. The business cycle has to take over, and that's anybody's guess when it does.
Robin, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right. We'll take you up on that, Sir Robin Farzad, contributing writer at Bloomberg Business Week, our guest for most of all things political this hour. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. We'll have news coming up in just one moment. Please stay tuned for the second hour of the program. Some of you, I hope, have had a chance to read. If not, we'll have it on our Facebook page, Fear of a Black President, which is in the current issue of The Atlantic and takes on some very, very interesting issues. So that's coming up. The second hour of our program. Phone calls, as always, will be welcome for that as well. So stay with us. We'll have news and then we'll return. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.